Main speaker for this evening, Brian L. from SD.
Brian, alcoholic.
Brian.
Thank you, Nick, for your service. And congratulations to Louie, 4 years, 90-day token, and also, I think it was about 20 people, 30 days and under. I know a lot about that because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I spent 13 years of going to meetings in and out before I ever received a one-year token. So I spent a lot of time in early sobriety simply because I wasn't willing to do what I needed to recover from this hopeless state of mind and body. So I, too, grew up in Massachusetts. We've got a little Massachusetts connection going here tonight. I grew up in a good family. I was one of seven children, very active in sports. Early on, my father said to me after he seen me drinking, matter of fact, my first drink was right around Christmas time. My parents were getting ready for a Christmas party, and I stole a bottle of Beefeater's Dry Gin. Never, ever, ever touch that again. Me and my best friend went out in the woods, and we drank that. Pretty much 25 years later, I walked out of the woods. It was just, a lot had happened. When I went home that night, my father saw my condition, smelled the cigarettes on me because I stole some Lucky Strikes, and he thought it'd be a good idea for me to sit down with the men and have another drink and smoke another cigarette, and then I went upstairs and to put my foot down on the floor as my world just spun, and I couldn't wait to do it again. Because I just felt different, you know, that ease and comfort I learned later from taking that first drink. I wasn't shy, I wasn't introverted, but it allowed me to just kind of take it to another level. My father noticed early on that I acted a little different.
Like 6 inches.
Okay. It's okay. Okay. He says, not that you're doing anything different than your brothers and sisters do. It's just you just don't know when to stop. You just take it to another level. And that just advanced, as come to find out, my disease started progressing in me. So, you know, when I cross that line, I don't know. I don't care. It doesn't really matter. All I know is I raced across it. 19 years old, my girlfriend had got pregnant. I didn't know what to do, nor did she. She went to her older brother. I went to my older brother, and coming from good Catholic families, just a couple months later, we're walking down the aisle together. I was not fit to be a father, a husband. I could barely take care of my own things because the alcohol and drugs, I did a lot of other hors d'oeuvres too, but I'll stick to the booze. But irresponsible. I heard that time and time again from my father. Irresponsible. I just don't understand you. My brothers and I had a barroom. Thought that was a good idea. I came home one night, as usual, probably 3 or 4 in the morning, and my new wife with my new baby, she grew up with an alcoholic father, and she said, you know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do what my mother did. It's either you're drinking and your lifestyle or me and your daughter. And I looked her right in the eye, and I told her not to make me make that decision because she'll lose. Egomaniac. Thankfully, you know, she did the right thing for her and my daughter and removed herself from that situation. Pretty promptly, actually. I went home the next night, threw my coat over where the couch used to be, and landed on the floor. I started reaching for the lamp and couldn't find that, and I flicked the light on the wall, and it echoed through the apartment. And I had no problem with that. She left my stereo with my albums. I crawled up listening to Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Four-Way Street, and I said out loud, she'll be back. And I just got up and went to work and did the same thing, and she didn't come back. And now I had another excuse why I wanted to keep drinking the way that I wanted to. So problems at work, obviously. My brothers, problems with the business because a lot of it was going towards other hors d'oeuvres. My family started to disown me. Family's everything to me. And pretty soon, my family started pulling away. My mother was the last one. My father pretty much gave up on me. They changed the locks on the door when they'd see me drinking. To the point where my mother called me up one time when they were having a birthday party for one of my brothers. And she called me up. She said, "We're going to have a party for Paul on Saturday." I said, "Fantastic. What time?" She goes, "No, we're just letting you know because we don't want you to come." And that's what booze had done to me. It's not what I expected it to do. I was just out to have a good time, you know. I just thought I drank a little too much. I didn't think that it was affecting everybody else the way that it did, the way that it tells me on page 18 in that book. But I really didn't care. I wasn't willing to change. I fought for my right to drink right to the end. And eventually one of my brothers got sober, took me to a meeting. I heard some people speak, and I just absolutely was not ready for that. Didn't want God in my life, had some problems with God already. Pushed him out of the equation early on. Because some of the things that I was doing because of my drinking, morally I just knew I wasn't living a good life, so God had to go because I couldn't have that weighing on me. Relationships meant nothing. You know, it's sad to say, but I wasn't capable of being in a relationship. I had absolutely nothing to offer. But I'd lie my way to do anything just so I had that comfort, so I didn't feel alone. And, you know, I heard it at meetings, never really registered, but then one day it did. You know, it's that alcoholic feeling of 3 o'clock in the morning in my life all day long. And I understood what that meant, but I couldn't let anybody know I lived that false life. My first real attempt, I went to a rehab, and I went to a halfway house in Boston, and I was about 5 months sober. You know, you had to get a job and all that, and I didn't make no big deal of that. I got a little, you know, get-well job. I had a Cadillac, 1976 Cadillac Coupe de Ville. It was about as long as this room, right? It was bad, right? First car that had air conditioner, power windows, leather seats, and I pimped that out. I took the trunk and I converted it into an insulated cooler. I put a keg of beer in there, and I had my tap guy from my liquor distributor run the cord all the way up into my console, and just a rolling bomb. And I was thinking about that when Valerie was saying about her meeting. I get kicked out of the halfway house. I used to leave the car at my parents' house out of the city. I went and grabbed that and took a couple of my friends down to Cape Cod for a weekend getaway. And we're up all night doing our thing Friday and Saturday. We stole an anchor at one of the parties. We got kicked out of that. We pulled up to the next one. My buddy threw it out the window. "Way anchor." Smashed off a car. We didn't even get out before we got in a fight. About 9 o'clock in the morning, we're rolling back up towards the city, up the highway, and I looked in the rearview mirror. I've got me, two of my buddies, a vanity cabinet, mirror in the back seat, beer cans and cups up to their knees. And there's a trooper behind me. I had also lost the shocks in the back of my car, so I can imagine what was going on, you know, every little bump I hit. So I got pulled over. And this was like a 1982 or 3 or 4 or something like that. And yeah, they were a little more lenient, I guess. So the cop, you know, pulled me to the back of his cruiser and had a little talk with me, told him where I was coming from, told him where I was going, gave me a little failed sobriety test, told me to get back in the car, go back up to the city and go home. Opened up the car door, and I sat back in the seat, and as I went to close it, he grabbed the door before it even closed and yanked me out, spun me around, and threw cuffs on me. I said, "What are you doing? I thought you said I could go." He says, "Yeah, that's before you got into the front seat of my cruiser." Yeah. Funny now. Yeah, not too funny then. Yeah. Wonder where I got the shotgun. So he let my buddies just drive away. He gave all three of them a sobriety test. One of them he had to wake up, and he was the one he actually let drive away. I didn't see my car for about 3 days. And then shortly after that, it just disappeared. I never saw it again. I couldn't report it stolen because I didn't have any. It was unregistered and uninsured. I never saw the vehicle again. All the years of trying to get sober, I was just hoping one day somebody would pull up at a meeting with my car, get my golf clubs and my hockey equipment out of there. But it wasn't all fun and games like that. You know, there was those weekends that I'd leave my daughter on the step. Well, I was supposed to pick her up at 5 o'clock. There were true intentions of, after work, going down, having a beer, go and pick her up and go home. And just for some reason, just that epoxy formed, and I couldn't get off that bar stool. And once again, I failed. And thankfully, she didn't let me keep coming in and out of my daughter's life. She said, either you get sober and show me that things are going to get better, or you're not going to see her at all. So unfortunately, for quite a few years, I didn't see her very much at all. My daughter's never seen me drink. But that doesn't mean that I was a good dad with her. It just means that I wasn't around very often because I did a lot of drinking. So it was June 1st of 2001 when I once again just was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't know if this attempt was going to be any different, if it was just going to be a vain attempt of just spin dry or whatever, but I called a friend that I worked with, asked him if he could take me to a meeting, to take me one out of town so that, when I ran into people I knew and they asked me that question, how you doing, my typical response is fine. I'm fine. Fantastic. Everything's good. Making, $1,600 a week. I pay $100 a week in rent and I'm 4 months behind on rent. Things are good, Irresponsible. Just, I had absolutely no feeling. To the point that a couple of years prior to that, this is what alcohol had actually just taken from me. My grandfather, who lived with us for the last 20 years of his life, and he was probably the biggest figure in my life. I looked up to this guy more than anybody. And he was very sick. And he was in the nursing home and then eventually came back to my parents' house so he could pass in his own bed. And I got the call one day from one of my brothers that he was going to be passing on. Everybody in the family felt that he was waiting for me. And I said, well, I'm not going up there. What am I, like the Grim Reaper? I'll stay right down here. And he said, listen, you selfish SOB, you're going to come up here and you're going to do something for your family for once. So I get up there, was sitting with my grandfather reading a book that he used to read me as a kid, and all of a sudden he squeezed my hand, he sat up and he took his last breath, and I just froze. I didn't even know what to do. I went and woke my sister up, then my father, and we eventually woke up my mother, whose dad that was, and everybody came into the room and everybody's crying, but me, because alcohol had robbed probably one of the most basic human values. I mean, this guy meant everything to me, and I couldn't even shed a tear. I was just a shell of a human being. And that kind of plummeted me into about a two-year spin where I drank myself into oblivion. But on that June 1st, when I went to a meeting, within a couple of weeks I had met a man. I heard around here, when you're looking for a sponsor, look for somebody who has what you want. I also heard, find somebody who has what they want. And he had what he wanted. And I wanted to see that. I wanted to learn how to do that. So I sat and asked him if he'd help me. And he said, yeah, under a couple of conditions. One, we go through the steps, we go through the traditions, and we go through the 12 concepts of world service. I didn't know what those were. But I said, yeah, I knew what the steps were. I'd read them off the wall all the time. And he later pointed out, if you're reading the steps off the wall, you're pretty much going to have an off-the-wall program, right? There's a lot more to them than just that shade. So I said, yeah, he'll do anything you want. So I went over his house, and we're going through that book. He pointed out certain things like, You know, there's a promise after every step. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know that. Yeah, I didn't know that. You know? But when he got to page 18, and thankfully you have this big book because I don't have glasses, we read this. If a person has cancer, we all feel sorry for him. No one's angry or hurt, but not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in their life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentments, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children and wives and parents. Well, that was my resume right there. That was my drinking through everybody else's life. I didn't want to continue to do that. I needed to change something. And he started taking me through this process. And he asked me, qualified me as an alcoholic. And as I was telling him all these things, I was weeping. I wasn't even crying, I was weeping. And the snot's running down the nose, and you know, I couldn't see anything. He said, let me ask you this, Brian. He goes, do you feel bad about all the things that you've done? And I said, yeah. And he goes, and you think you're not even worthy of God's help? I said, yeah. He said, bad people don't feel bad about doing bad things. Only good people feel bad about doing bad things and act like that. You're just a sick alcoholic that needs to change the way that you're living. That gave me some hope. So I was back at his house. I think we did it like every third night. And he'd tell me some stuff. I'd tell him some stuff. He became the first man that I ever trusted in my life. I didn't know that. I used to think I trusted my friends, I mean, in fights and everything else. You know, I've been in every fight possible. Gun fights, knife fights, rock, paper, scissor fights, pillow fights. I lost them all, right? But I've never been in a fight like alcohol. I mean, that just beat me up for, it was 25 years. It was a 25-round fight, and I lost every round. So we got to step two, and now he's a practicing Jewish man, and I'm non-practicing Catholic, so I had no idea where this night was going to go. He said, how's your relationship with God? And I told him, it's not good. It's non-existent. I mean, I don't like it. I got rid of him years ago. I don't even believe in it. He said, all right, well, let me ask you this. How can you not like, or you don't even trust something you don't even believe in? He said, that just contradicts what you're saying. He said, well, let me ask you this. He goes, are you willing to believe that there's a power outside of you? It could be here, it could be there, it could be in the meetings, it could be in the book, it could be in, are you willing to believe that? I said, yeah, I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't. He said, exactly. Your process is taking step two right now. I felt pretty good. He goes, he said, and good thing is there's room for improvement. Obvious room for improvement. So, and we went through all the readings there. We got to step three, and he asked me that question. Are you willing to turn your life and will over to care of God? I said, not really. I think so. So let me ask you this. He said, there's three frogs in a log. Two of them make a decision to jump in the water. How many are left? I studied spherical trigonometry. I'm not bragging about that because the journey I took, I've pretty much erased all that. But I said, there's one. He said, no, there's still three. They only made a decision. You can make decisions all day long. I make decisions all day long. I made a decision I was going to go into work at 6 this morning. Then at 6 I made another decision I was going to go in at 7:30. So I can make decisions all day long. I'm good at that, you know, acting on them. He said, now we get into the causes and conditions. So we did pen to paper. He had me highlighting stuff in one color that I understood and another color that I might not have understood. And I was, you know, he gave me the dictionaries, looking up the words. And eventually I wrote down all my four-step stuff. And I felt bad. And he also told me, you know, while you're doing that, you also need to kind of balance that out a little bit. Don't write that at the end of your day and rush at the end of the day and then try to go to bed with all that in your head. That's not good. You need to kind of do something positive. You know, maybe read something more spiritual. Now, where I came from, I used to think sitting at a Neil Young concert on three hits of acid was spiritual. I don't know. I'm like, really? Huh? What are you talking about? Serenity, you know? I never had any serenity. If it did, it went through my life like a lightning bolt. You know, but I can have serenity today in the middle of a storm, even if it's for a brief moment, like I was saying I did today, you know? So then it came that time where I had to sit down and go over all this with him. I mean, he was reviewing a lot of it, making sure I was writing the proper columns and all that. But then that came that time for the fifth step, and I had written a few things over on the left-hand side. I'm a lefty. On the left-hand side of the page in hieroglyphics, because I needed to feel him out first. I needed to throw out some of this lighter stuff. And then we went over all that stuff, and he asked me those questions as you're supposed to ask. You know, did you try to make mortar without sand? Did you leave anything out? I'm like, oh no, I'm good. And we started reading the fifth step promises, and I didn't feel it. I didn't feel that I can now face the world. I can now look the world in the eyes. I didn't feel that because I had held a few things back. I called him up. I think it was the next night. I forget if it was that night or the next night. He said, "You're going to be okay till we meet again." I said, "Yeah." I said, "I just got a couple of things I got to go over with you." I just went over there within 5 minutes. I said, "Here's what it is." Then when I walked out his house that door that night, I felt some peace. You know? I felt some peace. I admitted to God, myself, and another human being, pretty much exact nature of my wrongs, the best I could do. Because I also had to look at it, just like when we got to step six. I truly, and I still struggle with this, entirely ready to have God remove my defects. I try to remove them. I try to remove them myself. It's problematic. It has been for years. Valerie will tell you that, right? But, you know, I hook back up with God. I try to keep that rate close to my life. A lot of that, what's going on in my life right now, that's where it's at. But, you know, the things that when I prepared my list and started making amends, he didn't have me go out and make those amends to my family right away. You know? I said, well, why not? I mean, those are the most important people in my life. He said, I want you to kind of get a feel for how this goes. You can do what you want, he said, but I suggest that you go with some of these smaller ones. You know? Get a feel for it. Refine it. Then eventually, you know, I sat and made those amends with my family. My father, I remember the amends I made with my father was down in Florida when they were down there on vacation. And we got a call that my father probably might not make it through the night. So we were on a plane, my two brothers and myself. Thankfully, we got there. They got him stable. And within a couple of days, him and I were 5 o'clock in the morning underneath the bridge as all the boats are getting ready to go out fishing for the day. And I formally made amends to my father, and it was pretty cool. You know? He said, "You're going to be all right, Brian. You know, just keep. I don't understand why you can't just have a drink, but just do whatever you're doing. Do whatever you're doing." And you know, then eventually, amends with my mom. I asked him if there were some things that maybe bothered her that he was aware of that I might not be aware of. He told me of about 4 hours worth of them. And I made those amends, and then my sponsor prepared me for the maintenance steps. You know, taking that inventory. For years, I used to walk around with a pad of paper and a pencil in my back pocket because I was making mistakes all day long. I couldn't wait till the end of the day. It was happening all the time. So, and he says you prepare yourself for one of the greatest gifts. He even tells me in the book. One you must not miss, and that was helping bring somebody else through the process, which is what he told me one of the conditions of him working with me was. He said, my job as a sponsor is to bring you through this book so that you can find a power greater than yourself. Rely more on that and less on me so that I can go work with somebody else and you can do the same. And that's an amazing gift, you know? Amazing gift. Now, don't get me wrong. It's not. I analyze things in my head when I hear people. Obviously, the book says many of us have recovered. I don't know if I recovered from alcoholism. I haven't recovered from 2003 when Aaron Boone hit the home run in the series against the Red Sox. I still need therapy for that. So, but what I have done is I've recovered some things. And I was thinking of this when Nick and I were outside talking. He was telling me a story about our grandson. And just a couple of months ago, now, remember, my grandfather passed away with me holding his hand. I couldn't shed a tear. I had been robbed of just the basic emotions of a human being. And Nick will probably identify with this after what he told me earlier. So Valerie and I were sitting there, and we have our grandson over all the time. She's just amazing, coolest nana in the world. So he's sitting there at the table. We're talking about something or other, what we're going to do the next day. I'm just staying over. And what he wanted to do, from the mouths of children, from the mouths of babies, right? He wanted to make sandwiches and go give them to the homeless. Right? I started weeping at my table. He's looking at me like, "You okay? Are you okay?" But, you know, those are the things I've recovered. You know, I've recovered trust. I've recovered faith. I've recovered being accountable. Now, just my family's gone through a lot in the last couple of years. And if my whole journey since 2001 was all for one moment last year, I'd be completely satisfied with that. As Valerie and I took Robert and our grandson back to Massachusetts for a vacation, and while we're back there, my dad ended up in the hospital, I think like a day after we get back there. And, you know, we've got a large family. Everybody was in and out, and we thought he was coming home. We were preparing for the hospice and all that. But I ended up staying that night in the hospital with him, and things went pretty south. And the doctor that was on that night told me my dad wasn't going to leave. He wasn't going to go home. So, you know, I sent my sister a text and preparing her to go pick up my mom and get everybody in. Now, we had people that were Red Cross flying some of my nephews off of ships to get them back, and they were back in that hospital within the day, 2 days. But that night, if my sobriety was all about that, I could die a happy man. Because my father said some things to me that night that blew my mind, right? And that's sobriety. That's like no high I have ever gotten. And I've had a lot of highs, a lot of good highs. But to see the look in his eye, you know, and to know that he was at peace and know that he appreciated me being there meant the world, you know. And I was able to be there for my family, as I should be, help get things taken care of and be there for my mom. We're going back in a couple of weeks for a wedding. And we'll go deal with all the chaos, you know. And Val's mom, matter of fact, might be coming back with us for a while because we're sober and we can do that, right? So I know what it's like to be sitting out there lost, you know. Everybody in this room walked in the doors for the first time, you know. We're not unique, you know. But if you're struggling, you know, I've got a friend in the room who had a major loss that I couldn't even fathom, you know. And we were talking earlier, and if his whole sobriety was to be there for what he was doing today with his family, then I'm sure he felt the same way I do when I was there with my family. And that's what it's about. So how much time do I get anyway?
15 minutes.
Okay. So the joys, you know, the gifts. I mean, we know what happened. We know how I ended up getting here. So being there, you know, I did. I met Valerie at a coffee pot back in my home group back in Massachusetts, and I remember the day she walked in the room. And she, come to find out, her sponsor was a good friend of mine. So that was my in, right? Well, so I went kind of sashaying over there and threw out all my good stuff. I just threw it out there. Hey, Kathy, how you doing? Who's this? Kathy, go see my mom. You know, I see my mom all the time, making sure she's hearing all this. You know, probably cook for my mom because obviously I was a chef for many years. And, you know, so I'm a mama's boy. I'm a good cook. I don't do laundry though. So I'm throwing it all out there. And I remember asking Valerie. I asked her sponsor first. I said, "It'll be all right if I ask Valerie if she can go out for a cup of coffee." She said, "Yeah, you're a decent guy. Why not?" Yeah. And I asked her, and she said no. You know? I that was my game. I just threw everything out. And I'm like, I don't even know what to do now. That was it. So now I was just embarrassed whenever I saw her. But it wasn't long after that. We're out on a meeting, and after my group. Back there, you go out as a group to other groups. It's called a commitment. And you get usually some of the best meetings I had were in the cars on the way to and from meetings, especially in early sobriety. So the groups would gather up. You get like 8 or 10 or 15 or 20 people. You go out and speak at another group, and it was like a Grateful Dead rolling show. We had a blast doing that. But she had heard me speak at a meeting, and afterwards she goes, yeah, I think I'll have that cup of coffee. I don't think we had that for 12 years, but at least not technically. But, we made the decision to move out here 4 years ago. Just past 4 years ago to help with Sage. Right, help be there with our grandson. And moving out here when he was two, we went from a 3,500 square foot home, her and I and two dogs, to a 1,000 square foot home with four of us and two dogs. And serenity really wasn't, you know, coming in out of my life very much at that time, you know. Struggling, you know. But you know, we went through a period ourselves when, even when we moved out here, when things weren't well. Things weren't well with us, and we split up. We're heading for divorce. I moved back to Massachusetts. My oldest brother was fighting and losing a battle with cancer. I transferred back there with the company I was with, and I spent 6 months back there. And I was as lonely could be, you know. But God saw it fit that we give it another shot, and things have been pretty good. And she tolerates me. She runs a much better program than I do, I think. But you know, when I was talking with you, the quest for me is simple. You know, I need to try to find God every day and every moment, and I struggle with that. You know, but I will not lie to you and tell you I just walk around through a Dewey Medal holding hands with God all day. That just doesn't happen. I struggle because the first thing I do when I get up in the morning, and if I go have a cup, go down after having a cup of coffee, maybe I stop to get one on the way. Same woman will ask me the same question all the time: "How you doing?" It's too early to tell. I haven't had a deal with anybody, including myself. So it's only when I interact with other people that I, you know, usually veer off the beam because I'm very stubborn and like things done a certain way. So the quest is to try to find God to help me balance that out, you know. And you know, coming from somebody who absolutely turned his back on God, one of the things, strangely, it happened. Well, not strangely, I guess it was by design, but I actually become a minister in our church when we're back in Massachusetts, Valerie and I. We had attended what was called a Crucio. It was a course on Christianity. It has nothing to do with AA, but that was just a path that we had gone down. And we got commissioned to be Eucharistic ministers in just an amazing church in Boston. And I remember the first time that I served communion to my mother. And then we talked. I'll give you the whole story. So we served communion. And I think our very first time serving communion, and we're leaving this downtown Boston church, and we're just like on fire with God's like everywhere, except with me. Because as we're getting ready to leave, we're in Chinatown, getting ready to leave, and they're shutting it down for some parade. And the guy, he's not a cop, he's just a regular guy. He said, "Oh, you got to go the other way." And I lost it on him. You know? And Val's like, "You need to turn back around and go back into church?" It comes, it goes. I mean, I got to stay on top of it. But, my sponsor had told me when him and I were going through steps two and step three, he told me these are the ones that are continue to evolve over a period of time, you know. You've opened the door up, like it even says. You're keeping the door open. You've got the foot in the door. Now you haven't closed the mind to all the spiritual principles of the program, that contemporary investigation. So he told me of a story of what's called the lamplighter back in England, back in London before electricity. And I was sitting there, I'm like, where is this going? He said, all right, so before electricity, this guy would, the townspeople would sit on the outskirts of town up on the hills, and they'd watch this guy go through and light the gas lamps throughout the city. He never followed the same path. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So, he'd light one here, and then all of a sudden he'd light one over there, and he'd light one over here. And I said, what's the moral of this story? He said, it's just like God, Brian. You never know where he's going, but look around at the people in your life. You can tell where he's been. Look at the people in your life, right? I see my wife every day. God's just all about. And I got good friends here. Same thing. I get to pick and choose nowadays who I, hang around with. And I typically like to hang around with people that are working in the solution, But I still have to keep, myself active and maybe some beginner meetings and make sure that I make myself available. Because when I think the most impactful thing when my sponsor was going through this book, aside from page 18 and page 52 and 62, 52 talks about the bedevilments. And when he read me this, that paragraph, my life changed. That was one of those moments. And he said, Brian, let me ask you this. He goes, you having problems with personal relationships? You having a problem controlling your emotional nature? You're full of fear? You having a problem making a living? You seem to be of any use to anybody? And I was like, no. He said, do you think alcohol has anything to do with them? Yeah. He said, that just goes to show you, just an alcoholic. He said, so when you took alcohol out of your life, he said, you took the most important and powerful and influential piece out of your life like that. He said, until you replace it with something of equal or greater value, you're going to suffer. You're not going to struggle. You're not going to have a hard time. You're going to suffer. He said, but more importantly, the people around you are going to suffer. I said, well, what's the answer? He said, look at the symbol of our program, Unite, Recover, and Serve. You replace that ease and comfort you used to get from booze, you replace it with that, and I will assure you, you will live a full life. And that's the path he started walking me down. So he told me page 52, and then on 62, it's the arch. 62, where it tells me that, God is a teacher. He's the principal. I'm the student. He's the father. I'm the son. He goes, through that relationship is where you're going to walk the arch to freedom. And he looked at me and said, do you want to be free from this life you're living? And I was weeping. I said, absolutely. He said, then let's do it. And he said it just that simple. And it's been an amazing road. I've had probably the toughest years in the last 2 years of my life. But thanks to AA and the people in AA and the principles of AA and having God in my life, I've been able to be of service to people and my family. That's a powerful statement. We come from all different walks of life, people that normally wouldn't mix, they say, right? I had no idea where my information would come from. I heard a guy when I was at that Green Harbor meeting 12 years ago, I remember hearing this. And this guy from Quincy, the guy that I didn't like this guy, but he had some good stuff. And it goes to show you, that's how much I know. He said he had this sponsee come up to him that was struggling with something going on in his life, who the sponsor had no experience with that. So the sponsor did what was right, and he said, I have no experience with that, but I do know somebody in the program who does. And I'm sure he'd be more than glad to help you. You want me to see if we'll talk to you? He said, absolutely. Who is it? Well, it's Brian over there. Every time that guy talks, I got to get up and leave the room. And he drives me fucking crazy. Goes on for like five minutes. And the sponsor says, are you done? And he goes, let me ask you this. He said, did you ask God for help this morning? And very smugly, I guess the guy said, I most certainly did. He goes, well, guess who he sent you? You don't get to pick and choose where my information comes from. It's a perfect example for me. When before we moved out here, I traveled the same route with OCD. I get up and I stop at the same, right up the street from my house is a gas station with a Dunkin' Donuts in it. One morning I go to pull in, and this car pulls out in front of me. It just absolutely cut me off at 5 o'clock in the morning. I just hit my must be in a rush. No problem. The very next morning, the exact same guy did the exact same thing at the exact same time, and I hit the roof, right? I started following him down the road, right? I'm going to cut. And all of a sudden, I looked at myself in the rearview mirror, and I said, dude, what are you doing, you know? Right? Turned around, went back up my coffee. I'm a drunk, not a monk. You know, I'm gonna struggle with myself all the time, and my interactions with other people. I'm abrasive at times. I'm very opinionative, but I never try to harm anybody intentionally now. You know, I had no problem doing that before with weapons or anything else, or just with the word of the tongue. You know, just, but, you know, so shortly after that, oh no, it was before that. I was talking with my sponsor about patience and tolerance, something I was struggling with. Still, here I am doing this thing. He said, well, pray on it. You know, pray on it. Pray for patience and tolerance. So we're coming back from, I was driving back from my group meeting one night, a foggy night, after a business meeting we had, and I had to get up and get to work. And the car in front of me is doing 20 miles an hour in a 40-mile-an-hour zone. And that was just unacceptable to me, right? So we're coming up. I know it's going to turn into two lanes. Now, I'm going left to get home, but it didn't matter what lane that car got in. I was getting in the other lane just so I could pull up next to him and do the what are you doing look, right? So the car pulls up, thankfully, and I thought God was working on my side because I got in the right lane, so I was still able to head home, not missing any more time, you know? And I get up next to this car, and I put the window down, and I look over, and it's this little nun, right? Just glued to the steering wheel, and I'm looking, I'm like, patience, and oh my God, I get the message, okay, loud and clear, hey, you know, are you all set, you know, I can get so self-absorbed, it's just outrageous, but because I have some things to check on myself, and I don't like to go, you know, through a day, I mean, I'll do that, and I'll get upset and angry and all that, but I get to reel it back in. You know, I get to be there, do things like this. I want to thank Larry for inviting me and then having a cookout and not having me. He must not have wanted me at his cookout because he had me speak. I'm not sure how that worked out. We'll have a talk with him tomorrow. Where's Larry? He has a cookout. I'm like, what? I work with him. He didn't tell me anything about a cookout. He told me I was speaking the other day. Right? You know, and what we'll do, you know, now tomorrow morning we'll get up. And my grandson will come running upstairs at probably 4 o'clock in the morning for breakfast, which will be cool, maybe 10 minutes after I get up. Hopefully I'm ready for that. And then we're going to go hang out with a friend who's going through some things and just be there. Just be there. You know? That's pretty cool. You know? I'm looking forward to going back and visiting our family. And when Valerie and I talked the other day, what about my mom? I'm like, have her move out here, you know. Have her move out here. So I got 1 minute. I want to thank you guys, and anybody that's new. I'll tell you, you know, find somebody. Everybody is here to help somebody. You know, just find that person. If you got something going on, you think you might pick up a drink, I'll be right outside. You know, I'll hang out with you all night if you want. I'm all jacked up. Just had a Red Bull. I'll probably go wake my grandson up when I get home, right? But again, thank you. Thank you very much.